computer to talk to them at 11 o'clock in the morning, which was 6 o'clock in the evening there, right just after sunset in Jordan. But we had a few technical difficulties, so I didn't get started until 1:10, so over 2 hours later. But it's kind of interesting giving a Bible study when nobody can see you. And of course you wonder if everybody's fallen asleep, because they might have done. So a couple of times during the Bible study I would say, are you all still there? And they were still there, they were listening, and when I said something funny they actually laughed. I could hear that, so that was good. The person who arranged it is a young lady from Zambia, and she's actually a student at one of our best universities now, but I've forgotten which one. Princeton, I think. She got a scholarship to go there. And she's doing this project in Jordan for a while. So it was interesting. And I don't know how the Jordanian government would have appreciated me quoting from the Old Testament, but hopefully they weren't listening in. And everything should be all right. Now, I've lost my glasses. Why have I lost my glasses? Without them, you're not going to hear much. So now, I know some of you are probably praying I don't find them. They might be in my briefcase. You know, I forgot to bring them this morning, so I had to call Diane to bring my glasses, and now I've lost them. Oh, I left them in the men's room. Thank you very much. It does. It gets worse as you get older, doesn't it? You just forget everything. Forget where everything is. You know, sometimes I go upstairs to my study to get something, and when I get up there, I've forgotten what I went up for. Well, I think what the subject I spoke on yesterday was a sermon. I used a sermon I gave at the feast on the Jubilee year. In fact, I gave it here on the Day of Atonement. And I'd been asked to speak on something along those lines, so I gave that yesterday. Today I'm not talking about the Jubilee, but I am concerned about something, and it ties in somewhat with that. And that is that I think many people are really just not adjusting to the reality of the significant change which is taking place throughout the Western world when it comes to our financial system. And I feel that some people, including some here, are heading for some serious problems if thinking and habits are not changed dramatically and very quickly. So that is the reason why I'm going to give this sermon today. I want to look at what's ahead in the economic crisis and how best you can cope. There's a principle in Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 3. Proverbs chapter 22 and verse 3. It says, a prudent man foresees evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. They suffer the negative consequences, basically. So a prudent man, a wise man, foresees the evil and hides himself. He prepares for it, in other words. He gets to work preparing for, you know, what is going to take place. And, you know, I think, you know, we're in a situation where a lot of people right now think that the stimulus package that Corbyn was talking about, for example, will solve all our problems and everything's going to be fine, so there's nothing to worry about. But, you know, that is not the conclusion of the financial press, the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, the Economist, Business Week, four of the most authoritative publications in the world when it comes to finances and economics. And they do not think that this is going to solve much at all, and that in actual fact we're heading for what President Obama described just a few days ago as a looming catastrophe. And, you know, we've got to prepare for this. And, you know, I find it's frustrating sometimes when I talk to people. I had somebody asking for help. They didn't have enough food. In fact, one in seven people now depend on food banks for their food. This is one in seven people in the United States. It was only one in eight just a few months ago, but now it's one in seven. And it just keeps on getting worse. And, you know, this particular couple needed food aid, and certainly, you know, we try to help. But in discussing their financial situation, they had a loan, a car loan of $490 a month. And then they also had a camper loan of $370 a month. So you add those two together, that's $860. Now, a couple of years ago, when they took on these payments, their finances were fine. He was working and she was working. But the problem is they both had a reduction in their hours because their companies are not doing very well. And consequently, you know, they now are in a desperate situation. They cannot afford their mortgage. Now, I would have thought the mortgage was more important than the truck and the camper, but, you know, he made the comment, well, we can live in the camper if we have to, and I've got to have the truck just to get to work and just to do my job. So, you know, obviously everybody has to decide on what their own priorities are based on their own circumstances. But having said that, here they are at a time when their income is down and likely to keep on going down, and yet they've got these payments. And so they did not have enough money for food. And, you know, I was very sympathetic, very empathetic, I hope, because frankly, any one of us in this room could be in that situation. As has been said many times over the past year or so, you know, you don't know what the next month is going to bring, and you don't know what your circumstances are going to be in a short period of time. So it's something we all need to think about. And, you know, I think many of us have thought about it. Maybe we don't want to think about it. Maybe you wish I was talking about a different subject. But the fact is, I think we're going to have more serious problems up ahead. And everybody's going to be affected one way or another. The church is going to be affected too. And our ability even to preach the gospel will be affected by this. So this scripture in Proverbs is a very wise scripture, that a prudent man foresees evil and hides himself to prepare for it. He gets to work, in other words. You know, he kind of disappears. He's not going to be very sociable now because he's trying to prepare for the situation that is coming. But the simple pass on. Some people are simple-minded. They don't want to think about it. They just want to ignore it. They'd rather turn the soap operas on, rather watch those than watch the news, which is so depressing. So, you know, we have to think about these things. Now, economics is not an exact science. It's very difficult to predict. We're not just predicting how 310 million people are going to be spending their money and how much they're going to earn, because we're talking now about a whole world. So we're talking about roughly 8 billion people. We all impact each other, and it's impossible really to predict exactly what is going to happen. But of course, some people try to do that. Paul Krugman, who's just written a book called The Return of Depression-Era Economics, wrote this in the New York Times on February the 6th. Now, Paul Krugman supports the stimulus package. He's similar thinking to the administration today. But he writes about the danger of deflation coming this year and then followed by inflation. But deflation is an immediate threat. Deflation is the worst thing that can happen to an economy. It's where prices are going down and you go into a downward spiral and the economy just keeps on going down. That's exactly what is happening to us now. And of course that means prices will come down, but it also means that wages will come down. And we're already starting to see that. GM announced this week that it was cutting people's incomes. I wrote to Sam Kellerman and asked him if he was going to be affected because he's, you know, one of the white-collar workers at GM, and he wrote back and he said, well, you know, all the white-collar workers are having their salaries cut by 10%. And he said, we're all wondering if Rick Wagoner, who announced a few months ago that he would just take $1 this year for working as the CEO, for being the CEO at GM, we're wondering if he's going to be cut back to 90 cents. So... at least they got a sense of humor, but you know it's a very difficult situation. They're cutting a lot of jobs, just like a lot of companies are cutting a lot of jobs. The state's going to be cutting a lot of jobs, you know. And Paul Krugman writes this: it's no wonder that most economic forecasts, warn that we're headed for a deep, prolonged slump. Some private analysts predict double-digit unemployment. The Congressional Budget Office recently warned that absent a change in policy, the shortfall in the nation's output relative to potential levels will be the largest in duration and depth since the Depression of the 1930s. So this is what is being written now. The British Prime Minister last week caused a stir. He used the D word for the first time. He talked about the depression that we're in now. And because he used the D word, of course, the newspapers, TV, pick up on this real quick, and they say, oh, it's obviously worse than, you know, anybody thought it was going to be. Well, last Sunday, the head of the International Monetary Fund said that this is going to be worse than the 1930s, and it's going to last over 10 years, was his prediction. And he also used the D word, and this was in the Wall Street Journal on Monday morning. On Tuesday, the Wall Street Journal said there's no way that America can lead the world out of this depression. Some other country's going to have to do it. We're not able to do it. I thought that was interesting, too, because we all know from Bible prophecy that there is going to come another superpower after the United States. And, you know, maybe that's what we're going to see emerging from this, because certainly there's been a significant change when it comes to what's happening in the world. As the great American economist Irving Fisher pointed out almost 80 years ago, deflation, once started, tends to feed on itself. As dollar incomes fall in the face of a depressed economy, the burden of debt becomes harder to bear, while the expectation of further price declines discourages investment spending. These effects of deflation depress the economy further, which leads to more deflation and so on. So as people's wages are cut, they can't afford to make the payments on their homes. They can't afford to make the payments on loans that they've got or on their credit cards. So you have more people defaulting, more foreclosures, you know, more job cuts because people can't afford to buy anything, so they're not spending. So we just keep on going down in a downward spiral. And this is what most economists are predicting now. Now, you know, whenever we've been asked to prophecy seminars, what we think is going to happen next, I always bring out that England was in this situation in the 1970s, that Margaret Thatcher came along and turned it all around. And it may be there's a Margaret Thatcher out there who's going to turn it all around. And that would be very nice. And, you know, I certainly hope that things will get better. But we need to be prepared for the fact that they may not. And there's still a great deal of reckless spending going on. And, you know, people are just not aware of the reality of the situation. You know, we don't go to restaurants as often anymore as we might have done before, but, you know, whenever I go to a restaurant, it's full. And I've often made the comment to my wife, and other people have said the same thing to me, you wouldn't believe there's a recession going on, would you? You know, I did talk to somebody this week who works in a restaurant and said one thing they've noticed in the past month is that people are not using their credit cards now, they're paying cash. So people are starting to realize it's a dangerous thing to do, to put something on a credit card, because you don't know if you're going to be able to pay it back next month. So pay cash. If you've got the cash, use the cash, and then next month you won't have that you know, heart attack from your credit card bill. Because that, I think, it sometimes happens when you get a big credit card bill. So, you know, some people are changing, but not everybody's changing. The same person who works in a restaurant also mentioned that tips now are 10%, that they average 10%, whereas what it was about 18%, maybe a year or two ago was the average, I think. Now it's down to 10%. So people are being a lot more careful. And some restaurants are saying they only make money on the drinks. They're not making any money on the food. People are being a lot more careful about what they spend because they're afraid of what lies up ahead. Absolutely nobody knows for sure that next month they're going to have an income. We just don't know. So, you know, we need to plan as if that is the reality. Now, you know, hopefully things will be okay. But, you know, the signs are not very good at this present time. And there are certainly all these predictions of deflation. And the stimulus package will help inflate the economy, because when you print more money, you have inflation. So it will help lift the economy in that sense. But then we could have inflation. And inflation can very quickly get out of hand. Because if prices go up rapidly, which is what happens with inflation, then everybody loses their savings, and the whole economy is thrown out of whack. You know, I was taught when I was at school that the primary role of government was to protect us and also to make sure that the currency remains stable. Because without a stable currency, without the value of the dollar, or growing up in England, the pound, unless it's stable, then everything's chaotic. And, you know, some people might benefit, most people lose, but nobody knows what's going to happen next. And I've seen that happen in different countries. Of course, the big risk of the stimulus package is that we're going to have a high rate of inflation. Because when governments print more money, that's the end result, inflation. Now, one country experienced both deflation and inflation in one lifetime, and that was Germany. In the 1870s, there was a depression which impacted the United States, 50% of the American people. In 1873, lost their jobs. In 1874, I should say. The depression started in 73, but it wasn't until 74 that unemployment was at its highest. It was 50%. And it started in Austria and Germany, and it's exactly the same as our situation today. It started with people foreclosing on their homes. It was a mortgage crisis, which then led to a banking crisis, which then led to a worldwide depression. So very similar to what's happening now. The Germans call it the Gründerkrach. I love those German words. The Gründerkrach, which actually means literally founder's crash, because Germany as a country was only founded in 1871. And this came 2 years later. It was the Gründerkrach, the founder's crash. And it was deflationary. Everything basically just went down. People lost fortunes. It was a terrible time. But then in 1923, they had hyperinflation. And there's actually film of this. You can see this sometimes on historic newsreels. During the period of inflation, prices were going up so fast and wages were going up so fast that everything was out of control. And in 1923, people were paid every hour at work. And they had to dash out after an hour. They got their money. They would run out. There's pictures of people with wheelbarrows full of money just running down the street, pushing their wheelbarrows with all this money just to buy one loaf of bread. And then they go back to work for like 45 minutes or an hour, get paid again, probably twice as much as what they got paid before, because that was how high the rate of inflation was. Then they'd run out again and get some butter or something to go with the bread, or knowing the Germans, probably sauerkraut and sausage or something. But, you know, that's what they did. This led to a total collapse, which in turn led to Adolf Hitler coming to power. So, you know, these are serious times and serious things. Now, hyperinflation, Diane and I have experienced that twice in our lifetimes. It happened in Ghana. We had a situation in Ghana which was just a nightmare, with prices just going up rapidly. Church members, of course, were paid the same salary every month. So every month, things were getting worse for everybody. People ended up having to grow their own food, so a lot of people went back to the villages. We started a farm for the church members just outside of Accra so people could grow their own food just so that they could survive, so that they could live. And, you know, it kept on just getting worse. And I've told the story before, but some of you are visiting today. I'll mention it again. I still remember in 1983 having to buy an air ticket. And at 3:45 p.m., we arrived at the airline office. I was with another minister, and I had a box full of money, you know, quite a big box. I was carrying it under my arm like this. This was the money to buy the air ticket. And I walked in at 3:45 p.m. and said, I need a ticket to, I don't remember where it was, England or somewhere. And they told me I'd have to come back the next day. And I didn't want to, because gas was rationed. There was hardly any gas available in this economy that was collapsing. So I didn't want to have to go back the next day. I said, well, why do you want me to come back tomorrow? They said, well, we close at 5, and it's going to take more than an hour and 15 minutes to count the money for the airfare. And so we can't do it. I said, look, trust me. The money you want, this is the exact money. I said, if you trust me, I'll give you a bundle for yourself. And I pulled out some more than I had in bulging pockets. And I pulled out another bundle. I said, here's your tip, if you trust me, that's the exact money. And they said, okay. And then they wrote me a ticket. So I got my ticket. But this is what you have in a hyperinflationary economy. And it's going on right now in Zimbabwe. It happened in Argentina, where Lydia comes from, years ago. So, you know, it's happened in many different nations. And, you know, we could have it happen here because we have lost sight of something fundamental here. We have lost sight of something. And that is that you must live within your means. We have had now two generations, you could say even three generations of Americans, have grown up without that understanding, without that concept. People do not realize that you must live within your means. And, you know, basically it comes down to credit cards, but also to loans and everything, people borrowing. And this really is a post-World War II phenomenon. In the last 60 years, borrowing has become much more acceptable and much more common. And of course, if people get maxed out because they borrow too much, they can just file under Chapter 7 or Chapter 11 and get out from under a great deal of their debt. And, you know, this has become a major problem because it's not just that we as a people, as a nation, do not have this concept, but of course our governmental leaders do not either. I first realized that about 15 years ago. If you remember, there was a scandal involving the Congressional Bank, and it was on the news for a few days, and then it was forgotten about. But at that time, there's a bank especially just for congressmen in Congress, and the Congressional Bank revealed that most congressmen were bouncing checks. And they listed the names of the 10 or 20 worst offenders. And one guy was bouncing checks on more than a daily basis, like 500 plus in a year. So that's more than one a day. And it just struck me, you know, if they're all bouncing checks, then obviously they can't balance their own budget. So how can they possibly balance the country's budget? See, there's no concept of it. So they just print more money. They just keep on increasing the amount of money. And we fail to understand this as a nation. The consequences of this would eventually be a financial collapse unless we get the spending under control. Neil Ferguson wrote a book about what happened in Germany called Paper and Iron. And he says the whole problem was caused by irresponsible fiscal and monetary policies. In other words, government overspending. And he said this benefited greedy industrialists while stripping the middle classes of their savings. Now, just change that word industrialist to bankers, and you've got the same situation today. Because what happened in Germany was, after World War I, the industrialists needed bailouts. So they asked the government to bail them out. The governments kept bailing them out. But when the government bailed them out, where did the money come from? It has to come from somewhere. And it came from the people in the form of taxation. So the middle class was stripped of their savings. They lost everything. And, of course, the industrialists eventually, they lost everything because they were running their operations inefficiently. Today, of course, it's the bankers. We bail out the banks. Somebody has to pay for it. Always somebody has to pay for it. How does government pay for things? One way is taxation. It gets the money through taxes. Another way that government pays for things is by borrowing, which means our children and our grandchildren have to pay the money back, plus interest. And a third way in which they can get money is through inflation. Because when they overspend, when they print extra money, because they did not get it from anywhere, because they're just printing the money, the prices of everything will go up. And as the prices go up, government is able to spend that extra money. But then people like us are the ones who suffer. And this seems a likely scenario for us. So we must be prepared for this. Thomas Jefferson said in 1802, "I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around the banks will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered." Now, you know, we could see this as quite plausible. It could happen. In fact, in a certain respect, it is happening. 2.3 million families have been evicted from their homes in the past 18 months. 2.3 million. They're predicting next year it will be 10 million families will be evicted from their homes because the situation is set to get worse, not better. Andrew Jackson said, regarding the financial situation at the time that he was president, the bold efforts the present bank has made to control the government, see, the bankers were trying to control the government, are but premonitions of the fate that awaits the American people should they be deluded into a perpetuation of this institution or the establishment of another like it. So warnings there about the consequences of what was going on. Now, one reason for all this is that we don't have many industrialists left. In fact, that's a large part of our problem, a lack of production. Where does wealth come from? It comes from production. Producing food, for example, we still produce a lot of that, but we don't produce much in our factories. And that's where wealth comes from, production. Government then taxes those who produce, and that's how government gets its money for the schools and for welfare and for anything else. So the less production we have, the less money government's got to spend, or they borrow it. Mark Faber is one of the world's greatest economists. He said just before the $600 rebate last June, he said the federal government, he predicted the 1987 crash, by the way, and told all his followers to get out of the stock market in 1987 before it crashed. So people often look to him for his opinion. He's a graduate, has a degree in economics from the University of Zurich in Switzerland. He says the federal government is sending each of us a $600 rebate. If we spend that money at Walmart, the money goes to China. If we spend it on gasoline, it goes to the Arabs. If we buy software, it will go to India. If we purchase fruit and vegetables, it will go to Mexico, Honduras, and Guatemala. If we purchase a good car, it will go to Germany. If we purchase useless items, it will go to Taiwan. And none of it will help the American economy. The only way to keep that money here at home is to spend it on beer, since this is the only product still being produced in the United States. And he says, I'm doing my part. So you see the problem. This is the problem we've got. We're not producing much wealth. We are producing some, but we're not producing much. But government is spending more and more, so we're heading for disaster. Now, look at 1 Samuel chapter 8, because God warned the Israelites that this would happen. He warned the ancient Israelites that this would happen. 1 Samuel chapter 8, beginning in verse 10. This is where Israel demanded a king. They wanted to be like all the other nations around them. We want to have a king. So Samuel in verse 10 told all the words of the Lord to the people who asked him for a king. And he said, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen. And some will run before his chariots. Now, let me just explain before we look at all of this. Before this, when Israel was a theocracy, you had the priests. Of course, everybody, according to the governmental system that God gave them, everybody was to give a tithe of their increase to the Levites. The Levites ran the country. They basically were in charge of education, and they basically ran everything. And it was done just on that 10%. In addition, people had to save 10% towards going to the feast. And then once every 3 years, 10% was given to help the poor and the needy. That was their welfare system. If you figure it out, the third tithe was in the third year and the sixth year. The seventh year was a land Sabbath, so they didn't have to do it again until the 10th year. So 3 times in 10 years means on average 3% of the country's income went to help the poor. Have a look sometime and see how much money we spend as a country helping the poor. You know, God's system was much more efficient. It was 3%, and people did not go without. In fact, the New Republic magazine showed some time ago that government is incredibly inefficient when it comes to helping people who are destitute. And they suggested that we hand over all of our welfare system to the Salvation Army, because they are much more efficient when it comes to helping the poor. And I thought that was rather an interesting article. And the New Republic is a very liberal publication. Anyway, Samuel told all the words to the Lord that the people had asked him for a king. And he said, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties. Will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. He will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves, and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage. A tenth? I think we all wish it was only a tenth. Government actually spends 46% of the gross national product. So it's almost five-tenths is spent by government. But you know what? This chapter is warning. God is saying to the Israelites, look, you're going to have a problem. You have a king. He's going to want to live lavishly. He'll want big government. He'll want lots of people around him to serve him and do all these other things. So the warning here is of an increasing tax burden. He will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves and give them to his servants. He will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. He will take your male servants, your female servants, your finest young men and your donkeys and put them to his work. He will take a tenth or 46% of your sheep and you will be his servants. And you will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Lord will not hear you in that day. That's interesting. Now this was a warning to ancient Israel. Deuteronomy chapter 28 contains a similar warning for modern Israel about the consequences of disobedience. And the term that is used there is that you will be oppressed continually because the taxation burden will become so great. And remember, taxes are not just what we pay in income tax or what we pay in sales tax or property taxes, but inflation is also a hidden form of taxation. And, you know, we're just going to be finding it getting harder and harder, is the warning in Deuteronomy 28. And this is exactly what God was saying here. It's also, by the way, what Thomas Jefferson said. My reading of history convinces me that most bad government results from too much government. That was what Thomas Jefferson said in 1802. All these quotes are from 1802. He must have said something in 1801 as well, because he was president then. But for some reason, obviously, he was talking about this more in 1802. Borrowing is another problem. This is another thing he said. It is incumbent on every generation to pay its own debts as it goes, a principle which, if acted on, would save one half of all the wars of the world. This reminds me of a cartoon in last Saturday's Lansing State Journal, where the new president is sat behind his desk at the Oval Office, and you know, he's listening on the phone, and somebody's the other end saying, you know, we protest strongly that the next generation, our generation, is going to have to pay for all this borrowing. We object totally to this. And so then he responds by saying, well, look, I know how you feel, but, you know, really we had no choice. We've got to borrow all this money so that we can stimulate the economy. He said, anyway, it's your bedtime, Malia and Sasha, his two kids. So it was his two kids that were on the phone in the cartoon complaining the next generation is going to have to pay for it. Sometimes I look at our grandchildren, I think, I don't think people realize just how difficult it's going to be for them, because they're going to have to pay back everything that is borrowed, and they're going to have to pay it back with interest. We are going to be, you know, subservient to other nations as a result of this. And I think really we're the first generation, the baby boomers, of which my wife and I are too, you know, we're the first generation that is actually deliberately making it worse for our children. I don't think any generation has done that before. But I think we're very selfish as a generation. Hopefully we're not here. But, you know, we're not thinking about it. So we're putting this burden on our children and on our grandchildren. Look at Proverbs 22. Proverbs 22 and verse 7. The rich rules over the poor, and the borrower is servant to the lender. Again, sometimes we forget that. The borrower is servant to the lender. Deuteronomy chapter 28 and verse 12. You know, here is the prophecy regarding Israel, the blessings and the cursings, the blessings for obedience. At the end of verse 12, he says, you shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. And the Lord will make you the head and not the tail. You know, you're the head if you're the one who's doing the lending. You shall be above only and not be beneath if you heed the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you today, and are careful to observe them. And then in verse 43, one of the consequences of disobedience, the alien who is among you shall rise higher and higher above you, and you shall come down lower and lower. He shall lend to you, but you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you shall be the tail. So when we borrow money as a nation, then we have to listen to the dictates of those nations that we borrow the money from. You know, so we lose our independence, so to speak. We lose our freedom as a result of the fact that all this money is owed. Now, you know, why the change? Why did it all change? You know, we used to lend to other nations. Now we borrow from other nations. The big change really came in the 1960s with the very liberal agenda of the 1960s. And, you know, I was a teenager at that time. And, you know, I still remember there was a euphoric feeling that we were changing the world and that, you know, we could solve all the world's problems. But, of course, it's also when, you know, the whole welfare system started, the Great Society was introduced. And, you know, there's been a lot of articles on this. One of the African-American writers in the Lansing State Journal, he's a syndicated columnist. Eugene Robinson, his articles go out all over the country. He had an article about a year ago which was very perceptive on this. He blamed the problems in the African American community on whites, but from a different perspective. He said, right up until the 1960 census, if you look at the census from 1790, every 10 years, right up until 1960, the number of African-American couples married in a committed relationship with their children living in one household was almost the same as the percentage of white people living like that. But then in 1970, it suddenly took a dramatic downward turn. So the number of African-American couples married to each other, you know, with children, declined considerably in 1970, again in 1980, again in 1990, again in the year 2000. So in the article he was asking, why? Because in 1965, liberal whites, well-meaning, decided to introduce welfare reform. That no single mother should go without financial support from the government. And also that no woman should have to live in an abusive relationship. So therefore, you know, let's help women with children. And so various programs were started. And as a result of that, as he pointed out in the article, you know, millions of African-American women just kicked their husbands out or decided to have kids from guys without getting married. And so we've seen this downward spiral. And he also brought out how, you know, this also explains why 90% of the people in our prisons are African-Americans, because there's no father in the families. And Shelby Steele, who's another African-American writer, wrote a book titled White Guilt. He blamed all of our problems on white guilt. Whites feel guilty about slavery, so they started all these social programs to help, but actually everything's gotten worse. And he said it's time white people quit feeling guilty and you know, get rid of all these welfare programs, basically. And you know, there's a lot of truth in that. Look at Hosea chapter 4. Hosea chapter 4. You know, basically what it comes down to is we've gotten away from God's law. There was a family system that existed for centuries, and right up until the 1960s, really. I mean, you know, clearly in every generation there's always been a small percentage where things did not go as they should have done. But basically for thousands of years, the family was the foundation of every nation. And this is why countries like China and India were doing so well, because they are still family-oriented. The great economist Adam Smith, who wrote The Wealth of Nations in 1776, said that if government gets off the backs of people and men are encouraged to work, given the freedom to do what they want, then a man will go out and work hard to provide for his wife and children. And that was the most influential economic book in our history. Alan Greenspan, when he visited Britain, went up to Edinburgh to see where Adam Smith came from. And he said, this is where it all started. The idea that a man should take care of his wife and his children. So if government gives the freedom, then we will have the prosperity. And, you know, that ties in with scriptures too. That was what was known as the Protestant work ethic. The Protestant countries became extremely wealthy because they were built on that principle. But of course, it's all changed in the last 50 years because government got involved, decided it could do it better. And of course, now, today, less than half the people live in traditional family units. And it's all, you know, it's all gone wrong. You know, another thing, of course, that's added to this is in the 1960s, you had the sexual revolution. You had the invention of the birth control pill, which, of course, led to immorality. It led to irresponsibility. And that also destroyed the family. In Hosea chapter 4, and here's a prophecy regarding modern Israel. In verse 7, the more they increased, the more they sinned against me. In verse 8, they eat up the sin of my people. So that the more they increased, the more wealthy they got, the more people turned against God. And that's exactly what's happened. They eat up the sin of my people. People are far more interested in gossipy programs on television than they are on serious news. They want to know what their favorite celebrities are doing, and that's what's being talked about here. In verse 10, they shall commit harlotry, but not increase. People are very loose sexually, but they don't have children. And that's another problem. Because people don't have enough children, that's another contributory factor to our economic problems. And, you know, in the past, traditionally, people had lots of children so that when they got old, the children would provide for them. They would take care of them. Again, government got involved and changed everything. Of course, now we see the whole system collapsing. So what are the baby boomers going to do when they get old and depend on their children? Some of them don't even, you know, didn't have children. Chapter 9, verses 11 through 14. As for Ephraim, their glory shall fly away like a bird. No birth, no pregnancy, and no conception. Though they bring up their children, yet I will bereave them to the last man. There's going to be a problem in terms of having children and not having enough for their old age. Now, all of this is of great significance economically. Genesis chapter 49 helps us understand that, because Genesis 49 is a prophecy about the 12 sons of Israel in the end time. In chapter 49 and verse 1, Jacob called his sons and said, "Gather you together, that I may tell you what shall befall you in the last days." So this is a prophecy about the time that we're living in. It's not irrelevant. It's not ancient history. It is about now. And in Genesis 49 and verse 22, it says, "Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall." So Joseph and Joseph's descendants were to be fruitful. And the prosperity that was developed in the United States and England and throughout the nations of the British Empire came about because they were descended from Joseph. And they adopted the ideas of Adam Smith and some other ideas which the Protestants embraced when they broke away from the Church of Rome, and it changed the world. Look at 1 Timothy chapter 5, for example. Here is a scripture. 1 Timothy 5 and verse 8. You know, the Protestant Reformation was in the 1500s. And when people got the Bible, they never had the Bible when they were Catholics. The Catholic Church did not allow the Bible. But when the Protestant Reformation took place, people were keen on the Bible, and they looked at the Bible, and they saw some of these scriptures, and they applied them. In 1 Timothy 5, verse 8, "If anyone does not provide for his own, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever." Worse than an infidel, it says in the old King James. And, you know, people believe this. So you didn't have a welfare system. Every man was expected to work hard to prepare, to take care of his wife and children. Now, of course, today, things are different. Even if a man wants to work hard, he might not be able to, because the economic system today is, Babylonish. It's crazy. Look at another scripture in 2 Thessalonians, chapter 3 and verse 10. 2 Thessalonians, chapter 3 and verse 10. For even when we were with you, we commanded you this: if anyone will not work, neither shall he eat. Now, Joseph, remember, was a fruitful bough. So this is the problem we've got, and we've got it not just in the United States, but in other Western nations too. It was highlighted in a magazine 3 or 4 years ago. I'm trying to get a copy of the article. I don't remember who wrote it, but I know he was an editor of a newspaper in Southern California. And he wrote about the crisis in California, which has gotten worse, and today is so bad that, California may be the first state to default. And already the governor has cut back on everybody's hours, and, they're having some serious problems out there. But the article he wrote said this. He said, it is the Anglos, the descendants of Joseph, who produce the wealth. And he said, as more and more of them leave California, and more people come in from the third world, the people from the third world, they consume the wealth. In other words, they need the government help. They need, the Medicaid, for example, which is costing them billions every year. And they need, welfare and unemployment benefits and so on. This was written a few years ago when things were still prosperous. But he said California's problem will get worse because every year more Anglos move out of the state and more people from the third world move into the state. This is exactly what's happened. And it's not just happening in California, it's happening everywhere. The New York Times recently had a front page article on how hospitals in the Northeast are overwhelmed and facing bankruptcy. And the New York Times, which is a liberal paper, said the reason is because so many immigrants do not have insurance, but the hospitals cannot turn them away. They're afraid of getting sued. They're afraid of being accused of discrimination, of racism, or whatever. And so they don't turn people away. But somebody has to pay for all those freebies. And that's people who have medical insurance. So they're having to pay maybe double to cover those who don't have it. So, that's the situation that we've got. Thomas Jefferson again said the democracy will cease to exist when you take away from those who are willing to work and give to those who will not. And that's part of our problem. I was talking to one of my son's friends recently. He was laid off at the time that Kurt lost his job over a year ago. And he's not worked since. He's a single guy. He has no desire now to go to work. He's quite happy to be on unemployment for the rest of his life. And, there's more and more people probably like that. And part of it is discouragement, but part of it is just the fact that government has made it possible to do that. And, obviously that costs money because it all has to be paid for. Kurt, by the way, started work on Thursday in his new job in the unemployment office. I may have said this, but when he got his job offer, the very day that he got it, the BBC had a segment on the state of the American economy, and it showed an unemployment line, and it said this is the only growth sector in the American economy today is the unemployment line. So I texted Kurt and said, I think your job's fairly secure for a while. So, it's sad, but that is the reality right now. And he also told me that in his orientation, they told him that, the worst time in American history was the Great Depression of the 1930s, which is not true. The 1870s and the 1890s were far worse than the 1930s. But, their history, their knowledge of history only goes back like 75 years. They don't go back any further than that. So, I showed him that is not true. Unemployment was far worse in the 1870s and the 1890s than it was in the 1930s. In 1932, it was 33%. But in the 1890s and 1870s, it reached 50%. So that was higher. And at least in the 1930s, government did do a few things to try to help people. But, you know, in the 1870s and 90s, it was every man for himself. Nothing was done to help anybody. And like I said, a lot of economists are saying we're going to go through the same thing again. The basic problem is too much debt. So how can you solve it? By adding more debt. And yet, that's the solution that is being set in motion. Neil Ferguson, who's a great historian, wrote in the Financial Times on February the 3rd, there is a better way to go, and he says it's in the opposite direction. The aim must be not to increase debt, but to reduce it. Because otherwise, we're heading for a collapse. We're heading for hyperinflation and a collapse, German style. And as has been pointed out, you know, when Germany collapsed through hyperinflation, you ended up with Hitler. A lot of countries are going to turn away from democracy. Even in my hometown in England, there's been demonstrations by workers in an oil refinery against foreign workers because the oil company was bringing in foreign workers to work for less than they were getting paid. And, they didn't like that. And, you know, so you're starting to see people getting ugly. There's been riots in a number of countries because of what's going on. And people are frustrated because they don't have jobs and, they just don't see any future. So you're going to see that kind of thing happening. Look at Haggai, or however you want to pronounce it. Probably even his wife didn't know. Look at Haggai, chapter 1. And verse 6, it's just before Zechariah, and after Zephaniah, that might not help you at all, but Haggai, it's page 1217, so just turn there. Okay, Haggai chapter 1, this was the situation at the time in Israel, in verse 6, but it describes inflation, hyperinflation. Hyperinflation was a major problem in the Roman Empire towards the end and was a contributory factor to its collapse. You have sown much and bring in little. In other words, you work hard, but you're not getting anything for it. You eat, but do not have enough. You drink, but you are not filled with drink. You clothe yourselves, but no one is warm. And he who earns wages to put into a bag with holes. So it's a description of inflation. It's because, you know, the money which you have really is worthless. So it's like having a bag of money with holes. It's just worthless. I mean, you know, you got to the point in Ghana. They used to say in Ghana when we went through our hyperinflation, you could tell a miser. A miser was, by definition, somebody who counted his money. Because most of us just weighed it. We just put it in our hand and just said, here's a million, take that. And if it was a couple of bills short and it was only actually 990,000, you know, who cares between friends? You kind of weighed money rather than counting money because money was worthless. And you'd even, you know, write stuff on money, use it as notepaper because it was cheaper than buying the notepaper. And in fact, you couldn't even buy the notepaper. So, you know, you wrote it on money, but who cared about money? It was just worthless. And, you know, we could have that too. In fact, The Economist said years ago, the great lesson of history is that all paper money eventually fails. It becomes worthless eventually. And, we certainly have that prospect happening with, what's going on. Now, remember in Revelation chapter 18 that a new economic system is prophesied to come along. And in Revelation chapter 18, I won't read all of this because... it's very long, but in Revelation chapter 18, beginning in verse 11, going through to the end of the chapter, you see the fall of this commercial system, which is, you know, a European-centered system tied in with the beast power, which is prophesied to come along after the period of domination by the Israelites. Now, some in the churches of God believe this is talking about America, the fall of this commercial system. And some say it even is talking about September the 11th because it talks about, the smoke rising up, and they say it applies to that. But verse 24 shows that it cannot apply to the United States because it says, regarding the fall of this system, in her was found the blood of prophets and saints and of all who were slain on the earth. And, America's been the one country that's given the most religious freedom. We haven't... killed any of the prophets or saints. So therefore, it's not talking about the United States. And we believe it's talking about the rise of the beast power. Revelation 17 talks about the false religious system, the Catholic Church and Europe, and you see that system throughout history. So it would seem as if from this that Europe's going to be the center of the new commercial system. And it describes here the fall of the system in verse 11. The merchants of the earth will weep and mourn over her, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Anyway, you can read it yourselves here. But the point is that another commercial system is coming. And I think what we're going through now is a transition from an American-dominated economic system to this new economic system that's going to be dominated by Gentile nations, principally Germany, the Germans, having learned the lesson of their Gründerkrach and the hyperinflation, the Germans will not overspend. And that goes for the ordinary people, just like us. They don't overspend. They don't use credit cards in restaurants, thinking they'll pay for it next month. Germany, with 82 million people, the last time I saw anything on this, had 2 million credit cards between 82 million people. We've got 82 million credit cards for every 2 million people. So it's the other way around, you know. We're addicted to spending, to overspending. If you have to put something on a credit card, unless you know you've got the money in the bank to pay for it next month, unless you know, then you're borrowing. And at this time, it doesn't make any sense to borrow. And I think we're going to see the Germans emerge as the dominant economic system as a result of that change. Look at Proverbs 22 and verse 3. Proverbs 22 and verse 3. Again, a prudent man foresees evil and hides himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. So understanding all of this and knowing the predictions about, you know, things in the immediate future, the next couple of years, you know, what should we do? How should we conduct ourselves? First of all, do not assume the bailout or the stimulus package is going to solve your problems. Because even the vice president said there's only a 30% chance this is going to work. It's not, and all the economic press, all the business papers say it's not going to work. So, just realize that we're going to be going through a difficult period. And, you know, these are things I've noticed with different people I've talked to, and I just bring them up, and you can go away and you can think about them, because I think that some people just don't realize what is likely to happen. Now, you know, I know somebody was telling me of their father, who grew up in the Depression, who had a heart attack, and when they were called to the hospital, the guy had thousands of dollars in his pockets. You know, those who lived through the Depression do not trust banks. Also, you know, I found with my parents that they grew up in the Depression, and they didn't like throwing things away either. And they certainly didn't waste food. You know, if you didn't eat all your food, they kept it till the next day, and then it was prepared in a different way as leftovers. And we're going to have similar things happening to us, too. We're going to have to adjust ourselves in some of these areas. Ghanaians don't throw away food. You know, people in Africa don't throw away food because, you just can't afford to do it. Food is too expensive and too precious. I've told the story before of when Diane and I lived in Ghana during the difficult years. We knew this American couple that come from Southern California. He was a millionaire over here back in the late 70s when $1 million was a lot of money. Today it's, I guess, still a lot of money, but not as much. And we were over at their house, and she spilt sugar on the floor, and she got down on her hands and knees with a brush and a pen and swept that sugar up and put it back in the sugar bowl. You know, when you're faced with economic problems, severe economic problems, no matter how much money you've got, it doesn't make any difference, really. So, you know, we're going to have to adjust. I'm not suggesting you get down on your hands and knees and pick up anything that you've spilt. We haven't come to that point yet. But the point is, we need to be very careful not to waste. Basically, what we need to do is balance our budget. We need to make sure we are not living beyond our means. And when you put stuff on a credit card, generally, you're living beyond your means. Unless you're doing it for convenience, knowing you've got the money in the bank to pay for it when the credit card bill comes. But if you don't, then putting it on a credit card means you're borrowing the money from next month's wages, but you don't know for sure that you're going to have a job next month. That's the problem. And that's the mistake a lot of people are making. There's a lot of prejudice. I mean, Wall Street Journal, for example, had an article on one of the fastest growing stores in America today is Aldi, A-L-D-I. Because Aldi reduces your grocery bill by 40%, but on average. But it's a German company. It only sells no brand names. It doesn't sell brand names, okay? And the prejudice is against the generics, as they're called. And the Wall Street Journal was asking why. It is starting to change. Now 25% of Americans buy the generics. But as the Wall Street Journal pointed out, when you buy cornflakes from Aldi, they probably got them from Kellogg's. You know, they buy them from Kellogg's in bulk, and then they have to put them in their own boxes, and the boxes may not look as nice as Kellogg's, and they don't have Michael Phelps on the box. In fact, Kellogg's won't next month. But anyway, the point is that you can save 40% on your groceries. They don't bag your groceries. They don't take checks. They don't take credit cards deliberately to keep the cost down. And they're one of the fastest growing stores in the world. In fact, out of all the countries I go to, with the exception of Ghana, Aldi's the only store that exists in all countries because it has this philosophy of giving people what they want cheap, basically. And when Kurt applied for a job there, he did research on the company and found that they will not sell anything unless it is at least as good as the brand name. That's their philosophy. And the only thing I would say they're not right on there is their tea. I have to tell you, their tea is not very good. So don't have their tea. But anything else is. The point is, though, again, we've got to live within our income. Everybody needs to cut back, but nobody wants to. That's the problem. None of us want to cut back. We're going to have to cut back. Live within your income and even save some money because, you know, the problems are not going to go away. We're going to go through this deflationary period where everything's coming down, including wages. And then we're going to go through an inflationary period. That's what all the predictions are. And it's going to be a rough ride. And, you know, if we don't realize that and don't face up to it, you know, some of us are going to have difficulty surviving through that period. So, you know, we certainly need to be thinking about these things and looking ahead, as the proverb said, you know, a prudent man looks ahead and prepares for the situation. So let us do that. Let's start the Bible study at 3 o'clock. Mr. Nance is going to give it today at 3, and we'll finish now and have a break before that.